me and my buddies, my sister and my little nieces. And then there was a picture of Elena out with her friends eating pizza close to a year before she was murdered. I know the pizza joint, right? There are pictures of me in that pizza joint, like, at another time. And she's smiling. When I saw it, I was just like, oh, good God. Like, no. And then, and then it was another picture of, of us like swimming in a lake up north or something like that. And I just, again, it was shocking.
That's heavy. Like, because it's true. It's a mistake for the algorithm, just, these little, memories together. Mm-hmm. And then there's some canned music and it can't help but get to you because it's using pictures of your own life. Mm-hmm. But then for not just the victim, but the murderer, smiling pictures of these people. Mm-hmm. So that's a mistake. Those aren't your loved ones. That's not your life.
No.
But like, isn't it? Like, how, who are you more intimate with? Probably not a long list of people.
No. I mean, sometimes I worry I'm too sentimental about this stuff, that it's almost inappropriate to feel like I care as much about the people I talk to and write about as much as I do. But call me a softie. This story was one of the fastest ones I ever did. It was about 3 months, and we were talking to, I think the number is somewhere between 40 and 50 sources who were like, the closest people to Elena and Mo. And, each one I would talk to for at least on average, like I would say, 5 or 6 hours, right? Some of them, like Joe and Anna, I mean, we talked for dozens upon dozens of hours. Do you know what I mean? To the point where they thought it was appropriate for Elena and Mo's son to call me Uncle Michael. You know what I mean? I would be, if I didn't sort of let myself be affected by the people I write about, I would never have, gotten to the point where I could get the story in the way I did, I think, because, by making myself available to them, you have to be like Data from Star Trek, a Vulcan, not to care, and it does affect me. I mean, you chopper into these people's lives, you spend huge amounts of time with them, you obsess over getting the story right, and then you kind of vanish. But all of these people in one way or another have kind of wounded me. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because, I think you have to care in order to do this job right.
And what about the murderer?
So there was a review of the book in the Toronto Star, and the reviewer said, I'm too soft on the criminals. And in some ways, I don't think that's true. In others, I kind of do. I mean, I do, people who do really horrible things, it's so easy as a reader to be filled with like a holy hatred for them. Do you know what I mean?
It's also boring writing.
I agree.
It's bad writing. Like,
I agree.
It's bad writing if they're just bad, bad, bad. And
right.
It's also bad writing if it's, the judge did in their ruling, or, I had a guest who's a gun advocate who was, what do we do about these mass murderers? And he said, well, there should be a law that you can't publish their names.
Right.
So I was like, that's bad journalism. the idea is like, we're not going to give them what they want. Mm-hmm. They're just evil. Them. They who shall not be named.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote, I remain unconvinced that I or my readers are best served by a narrative tactic that ultimately fails to inhabit the inconvenient humanity of criminals. You write criminals as humans in the way that people have been writing about crime for a long time. I mean,
right.
If there's any contradiction here, any place I want to push back on you, it's mm-hmm. It's a little bit too pat, the explanation you gave earlier. We write villains as main characters for a reason. They're the ones who make the most consequential decisions.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who make the consequential decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That's true enough.
Mm-hmm.
But we also write them because they're interesting.
Yeah, of course.
The villains in any story are almost always more interesting.
Of course, because first of all, they're rare, right? I mean, like someone who does something truly horrible is by definition sort of exceptional, right? I mean, not in a good way, but if you're looking at the sort of data set of humanity, there's this really small subset who are doing this sort of exotic thing.
Right. Outliers
right.
are interesting.
Right.
Surprises
right.
are interesting, and extremes are, I mean, it's, I mean, mm-hmm. and that's true whether it's just the news. The news mm-hmm. is not what happened today. It's the weird shit that happened
mm-hmm.
today. Stuff that wasn't supposed to happen today.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's also true of, whatever, literary nonfiction.
Right.
Like, what are you going to spend the time, like, and we're talking months
mm-hmm.
Or sometimes years delving into a crime. It was interesting, like, I was listening to James Gandolfini talk about The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting in this age where we're so interested in true crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true crime, but it's, you know, mm-hmm. close enough. Yeah, it's based on the truth. Like, the best true crime, or crime fiction, I suppose, isn't really about crime.
Right.
Like, and he was talking about The Sopranos, like, well, like, look, this isn't, you know, this show is about family, and it's about generational dynamics, it's about society, it's about friendship.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, it's, and then at the end
spoken
he goes,
like a gangster.
And he's totally right. He's totally right. And I suppose, like, there's no shortage of literature out there that's like, you know, three generations of a normal family. And there's tons of interesting stuff you can get into. But it helps if somebody killed somebody. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what, he's like, it's all that stuff. Plus you got the mafia stuff,
right.
which makes it a TV show.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you offer a complicated and interesting human portrait of this doctor who is somebody who you feel like you know at the end of writing it. And that's sort of what makes it so, you know, wow, this could happen to. But Toronto Life doesn't write cover stories of like here's an interesting Torontonian, you know, let's do a 5,000 word obit of somebody who died in their sleep.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. The question I always come back to is, especially in this sort of true crime boom moment that we're sort of living through, is it bad to be interested in criminals because they're criminals, right? Like, is there something that's kind of, there is like a sort of finger wagging sort of moralism from some crowds. You know the type, right?
And from you. And we all do it. Like,
right.
we kind of enjoy doing it. We're like, we're ghouls.
Right.
We're a bunch of vultures.
Right.
You know, like you said that you're proud of the story in the shameful way.
Right.
That writers of true crime can be proud of a work that is based on somebody else's misery.
Right.
But we're not really shamed.
Well, no. I mean, but it does make you a bit of an asshole if you're walking around being like, God damn, that's my best work. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean?
It's
like,
also honest.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. You know, true crime is, I think, interesting as a genre, not just to consume, but to think about, because it is this combination of all these things at once. It is, as I say, like, you know, when I was doing my first murder, you know, I had this moment when I realized it was wickedly fun. You know what I mean? It was delightful fun. I mean, it was great. You know what I mean? When you write a Toronto Life crime cover story, you know, it's in every single, you know, dentist's office in Toronto, right? Your mom's friend, your grandma's knitting partner, like they're all reading it, right? Everyone is consuming it. And I don't think there's anything immoral about the genre if you do it kind of morally. Do you know what I mean? Which isn't in some, I'm not one of those like sort of hair shirt wearing true crime writers where, you know, I'm sort of wallowing in abjection or anything like that. But it does contain these competing impulses where it's like, I am taking someone's pain, digesting it, and turning it into something that's somewhere between elucidating and titillating, right? And I think it's okay to have those competing feelings. You don't have to have one or the other, right?
Yeah. You know, I've known crime reporters who take it head on and sort of wear it in a like, yeah, I'm a piece of shit. And I think there's a certain attempted honesty in that.
Right.
You know, I guess the worst kind is the kind that like thinks that they are doing God's work.
Right.
Maybe the only real ethical way to do it is to wrestle with it and to be uncertain about it.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too, because I think your attitude about the genre comes out in every single sentence you write. Do you know what I mean? And if you are kind of like the swashbuckling, hard-drinking, cigarette-smoking piece of shit, like, it kind of comes across, right? If you're the hair shirt-wearing, like, sort of abject, self-hating crime writer, that's going to come across too. In some ways, I think it does the sources.
And if you
delude
yourself, if you kid yourself into thinking that you're just representing victims,
right,
and telling the, you know, if you kid yourself,
right,
that it's purely a noble act.
Right.
That's a lie too.
Oh,
that there's no level of, like, you can't get around that there is exploitation.
Of course.
You're turning it into content.
Of course. And you're getting paid for it. And you're going to get a lot of, you know, eardrums and eyeballs paying attention to it. Right. So for me, like, being able to strike that balance between self-congratulation and self-hatred, I think that's the one that's not just the sort of best moral position. I think it's actually good for your work as a journalist, right?
Why do people need to know about crime? Like, there is prurience and titillation.
Yeah.
There is a porn aspect to it. Is it just that? And is that, like, to kind of get back to what we were saying earlier, you can basically sell a story that's a piece of literature if the character dies at the end in a grisly crime. And I don't judge. There's no shortage of, you know, you got to put asses in seats. And many of the issues-based journalism that we, you know, strive for and, you know, submit to awards needs something titillating or interesting just to get somebody there. So you could kind of look at the crime as like, well, like the James Gandolfini thing of like the mafia is what got the audience, but it's really not about that.
Right.
But there's another way of it, of looking at it, which is that, I don't know, do people need to know about crime because crime tells us something?
Mm.
There's a, I don't know if it was, I don't want to be quoting Robert Kennedy, but I might be. There's also, it was also said by Val McDermott, who's a Scottish crime writer. They both said that a society gets the criminals it deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I do think there is a way in which certain kinds of crime are a sort of emanation of the society in which it happens, right? That's true, for example, like, you know, when it comes to something like gun violence in America, right? I mean, by understanding...
Jeffrey Epstein,
right? I mean, the thing that I think is, if there is an issue in Love Story, you know, I think the most important one is that the reason why those initial headlines were written the way they were, brilliant neurosurgeon murders wife, is because there is a class element to this story, and that's important for us to understand about domestic violence, right? Like, domestic violence is completely blind to class, and yet I think undergirding the interest in the story is this sense that, oh, that there's a certain kind of crime that only affects a certain class, right? Like, how could a brilliant neurosurgeon beat up his wife for, you know, 15 years and then kill her, right? It seems he's too respectable. They're too rich, right? And I think that belies a silly and classist understanding of a societal ill that cuts through class, creed, and, you know, can affect everybody. That's what makes it surprising, right? That's the way in which it's a reflection of our, of sort of the preconceptions of our society, right?
Our surprise that this happened,
yeah,
between these two white-collar professionals,
exactly,
and not... in a trailer park.
Exactly.
Says something about us.
Yeah.
The way in which it happened between them, well, there's another story that you didn't have access to write about who this guy was and how, mm-hmm, he was brought up and,
mm-hmm,
how he was capable of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, we touch on it a little bit and, you know, we talk about his austere, prestigious upbringing that he had, which I think led to a sense of kind of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And that fed into the way that he behaved in his marriage.
It's inferred around the edges. You know, the biography, right, that you're able to offer about him, you can fill in the blanks of,
right,
like overachiever, striver,
yeah,
born kind of elite,
mm-hmm,
way he treated her. You know, you can kind of infer, and I don't think that's anything manipulative on your part because you didn't have access to him, and you lay out the facts as they are, and they, you know, they tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though, like, I always wonder, like, yeah, that suggests to me something, and I kind of just know that if you actually were able to go,
mm-hmm,
it would be different.
Yeah.
It might be inclusive of that.
Yeah.
It's almost never just the thing you think it's going to be.
The other reason I think that crime reporting is interesting to us, and also in its own way, I don't want to, maybe important is the wrong word, but the reason why it's still relevant, right, is because there is a way in which even when you do get really good access to a criminal or the family of a criminal or the people around them, there is a way in which however much reporting you can do about why the person became the way they are, very often you'll find there's something very mysterious and inexplicable and almost unreportable about it. Right?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, like it, you know, you can get as much of that stuff as you want and it still kind of feels like it doesn't add up. There's something that's mysterious and missing. That I think is the thing that fascinates not just me, but I think consumers of true crime, because it's like, why did this one break bad? Right? Why, what is that odd thing? You know, as a kid, I was kind of a hypochondriac and I was always worried about my appendix bursting. Right. And my interest in it was always something sort of like that. Like I was like, there is this old desiccated organ inside all of us that for some reason in some people just erupts. Do you know what I mean? And it almost feels like this is where I get the sympathy of criminals from, because it's almost like there is a way in which, of course they're culpable for it. Of course they should, you know, they should have to pay for their crimes. But there is a way in which they kind of look like the evil is riding them and not the other way around. Do you know what I mean?
I think I do. That's sort of one lens through which you can look at it, is like, what's broken in people that allows them to go to these extremes?
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a nihilistic way of looking at, like, bullshit. Nothing has to be broken. Anybody will do this stuff under the right circumstances.
Right.
I guess what draws me to one story and not the other and I cover different stories than you, but I take notice when there's a big crime and mm-hmm. you know it's going to be a big story. There's a lot of interest. And there's a process, whether I'm reporting or assigning people to things, where, you know, it's like story selection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does this mean anything or is it just another murder?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to suggest that my instincts are terribly good. Some of it's a matter of personal taste.
Mm-hmm.
But when Barry and Honey Sherman got murdered, I was like, pass.
I felt the same way. There was a second in which I was kind of like, do I have to do this one? And I'm kind of like, I know this sounds, you know, every life is valuable. But to me as a reporter, it was, and this is the crime stories that I don't want to do. I don't want them to feel merely anecdotal. Do you know what I mean? Like, there has to be something, it has to be a way in which the crime tells us something about ourselves, the systems in which we live, our preconceptions about why crime happens and to whom. Do you know what I mean? Like, it has to have some sort of surplus value than its mere newsiness.
I do know what you mean, and it's a really hard one to talk about because we don't know who killed them. But, like,
right.
you kind of run this ghoulish math, this algorithm in your head, and you're like,
mm-hmm.
look, I don't know. It was a business thing mm-hmm. or it was a family thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you kind of, like, run the different outcomes, not mm-hmm. knowing. And, like, mm-hmm. are any of those things about anything?
Right.
And I kind of was like, I don't see a there.
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
Good chance that we'll never know. And even if you do find out, good chance, it's like, yeah, like somebody hired killers because of a business thing or he had a relative, like
mm-hmm.
it's something like that. And I'm just like, you know, and knowing the investment that's required,
mm-hmm.
you make these judgment calls.
Yep. Part of the reason I didn't want to do the Sherman story, I had a friend of mine who's also a crime writer at one of the big dailies, and she was put on it briefly. And then she said, you know, essentially she was like, you know what? I don't want to do this story. There's no way we're going to figure this out. This was like months after, like, you know, the murder happened. She was like, we're never going to know. And it's kind of not worth the not knowing. I have done a story where we don't know who killed the person, but the reason I did it was because it was the story about the murder of Beverly Smith. And the reason I did it was because the police, in their attempt to figure out who did it, they deployed this Mr. Big investigation.
Which, oh, yeah, right.
Which is like,
that's,
you know,
fascinating.
Uniquely
yeah.
Canadian.
No, unsolved can be okay. You
yeah.
know? I mean, the indigenous deaths in Thunder
right.
Bay were,
of course.
Remain unsolved. But
yeah.
my God, the things that are revealed.
Yeah.
But there's got to be something. There's got to be something to chew on.
Again, I think it has to tell us something about who we as a people are, who we as a society are. And if it doesn't, you know, I'll let somebody else do it.
Has anything changed in how you approach this stuff? The next time you are, like, talking to a survivor of a murder victim, is it different than the first time?
You know, I think everyone's bedside manner can always be a little bit better. I think I'm more competent now, having sort of gone through it a bunch. Murders are, it's weird. Again, maybe I'm sort of like a softy, but I find that, like, you know, murders can creep up on you emotionally. Do you know what I mean? Especially at the beginning, it takes a lot of you know, sort of emotional fortitude to not just do it right, but to kind of be able to live with it. Now I kind of feel like, you know, it's not like I'm grizzled or anything, but I think I'm better equipped to be able to sort of dive into the dark with people who are grieving and do it without being sort of swallowed up by it in the way I had in the past. And I think that makes us better reporters, because you want to care, but you don't want to get overwhelmed, because then you're not doing your sources good. You're not doing your reader service.
Or any favors for your own health and well-being.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as we can talk about how sources lose sight of the line between a journalist and a friend or a shrink or
yeah.
an advocate.
Yeah.
You know, we can get lost too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the ability to get lost, I think, makes us good, but you don't want to succumb to it. You don't want to actually get lost, right? You want to make yourself sort of available enough that you're doing the story justice without bringing, you know, bringing harm to yourself.
Michael, this has been really interesting. Thank you.
Jesse, thank you so much for having me.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Danny Paradis, Western correspondent for APTN News. Hello.
Hello, Jesse Brown.
Welcome to Shortcuts, Danny, where we talk shit about the news. All right, Danny, it is a tragedy when important news goes ignored, and we don't let that happen. We duly note those stories. What do you have to duly note today?
I want to duly note an anniversary last week that I wrote on, which was actually the 150th year in operation of the RCMP, formerly the Northwest Mounted Police. And that kind of passed without the fanfare that I think we could have expected a decade ago.
Yeah, sort of a muted birthday, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. So I have a piece on APTN News talking about the 150 years of what I'll call unmitigated conflict with Indigenous people, interviewed Jean Taye and Steve Hewitt, went through, you know, a lot of the actions. Oddly enough, land has been an issue at the beginning, and it's an issue now. So when you see Wet'suwet'en, you see the conflict there, you see the claims of RCMP neutrality and how that usually works out when it's against Indigenous people. I think that one thing that Canada doesn't do is think about our institutions very deeply. And with the RCMP, you know, with Portapique, with the Moncton shootings, we've seen a bunch of mass shootings. We've seen members dying. We've seen over and over there's these recommendations and reports. That's what really struck me in that piece, is how many times we've gone through these like mass casualty events, how many recommendations come out, and then the failure to actually pick that up and run with it has been really egregious. So I think it's just a thing I'd like Canadians to think about is, as we go into the next 150 years, what do we want to see policing look like? What do we want to see our institutions look like? We are famously cheap. Look at what we're doing to like the Prime Minister's house. It's just in ruins and we won't fix it. Our plane is like a janky old plane now. But like, let's not do the same thing to our actual institutions, and let's think about what they should look like and actually take that time. And I just dearly wish that we did in Canada. You know what I mean? That's what I want to duly note.
Yeah, you know what? I think that we are like moving on the downslope from a rare occurrence where we actually have all thought about policing and looked at the RCMP. But the RCMP's history has been kind of lurching from scandal to scandal. And our default is like, you know, it's really hard to get people to care about this. We did a whole series on policing here. But getting people to care isn't the end of it. Like, if you don't do something, like maybe disband the RCMP, what was the point of raising that awareness? Check out Danny's piece. Duly noted. Danny, I can sound like a crank in my criticism of the CBC, but there's something that I think is just like, I'm on the same side as people who just love the CBC, and I love things about the CBC. All of that notwithstanding, I think we have more that we agree with than disagree with when it comes to the effort to get rid of advertising on the CBC. I think that's where people who love and use the CBC are aligned with publishers who resent the fact that the CBC is aggressively competing with other news companies that are struggling to stay around. No more ads. We've already paid for this stuff. And what I want to duly note today is that Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez has said that he is going to review the mandate for the CBC, which is so long overdue for so many reasons, and Radio Canada. And one of the things he's going to be reviewing is ways the government can bolster funding to the public broadcaster so it is less reliant on advertising dollars. And I'm going to leave aside the whole, like, do they really have to give them more money to get rid of the ads? Fine, give them more money. But yeah, kill the ads. I already see the problem here, less reliant on advertising dollars. The murmurings are that they're going to start with news and current affairs, that news and current affairs should be ad-free, and they'll keep ads on everything else. Hey, I'm a reasonable dude, and compromise sounds good with me. This is how it's done in the BBC for all their content. You've already paid for the BBC if you live in Britain, and if you watch BBC content outside of the UK, there's ads, but not within. That should be the model. And if that means giving them extra cash one way or the other, that's fine. But thank God we're looking at this. Ad-free CBC, better for everybody.
Duly noted.
That's That's shortcuts. That's shortcuts. Danny, thank you. Thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here.
We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Danny, where can people find you and your work?
You can find me at APTN News, or you can look on Twitter, where I'm trying to spend less and less time, but at Danny Parody. Let's be real, I'll still be there.
We need you there. This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Large trees bring a lot of benefits to cities. They offer shade and local cooling and help reduce stormwater runoff, so they can help urban areas adapt to climate change. But when new buildings go up, those stately trees are often cut down. Developers might plant new trees after construction is finished, but it can take decades for those saplings to grow to be as big and beneficial.
You can't make up for the loss of canopy by planting many small trees.
Keith O'Haron is an urban forester in Union County, North Carolina. His research shows that local laws, often called tree preservation ordinances, can help protect trees from damage during construction. These laws might require people to get a permit to cut down trees, or limit how many trees can be cleared for new construction. Some regulations also require fencing around each tree, to prevent workers from digging or storing heavy equipment in places that could damage a tree's roots.
To protect the tree, we have to protect the root zone, because that is the primary way that trees are indirectly killed during construction activity.
O'Haron says these laws are not intended to limit development, but to preserve trees and their many benefits. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.